I will now be the 10-minute speaker. My name is Hector, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have 10 minutes to talk on 10, 30. Well, you didn't care, right? Okay. I would like to start off by saying that recovery has been awesome for me. Spiritually, my higher power has been very, very great with me and loves me. And I know this now. You know, throughout my addiction and throughout my, I guess you could say, wrath, my disease really had a hold on me. I've been homeless. I've lost my 6 kids. My wife, ex-wife now. And along with everything that comes with that, a home, cars, everything. All because of my addiction, because of my disease. And as a father, a single father now, of 3 boys, I'm fighting for them. I'm trying to get them back. I went to court at the beginning of the week. They're trying to take my parental rights away because it's been 19 months since my kids have been gone and taken away from me. And according to CWS, time has expired on getting my parental or my, I guess you do programs to get work on your getting your kids back. And my time has expired. Well, that is true. It's been a long time and I'm barely doing good. I've been doing good since November. But the judge, instead of agreeing with CWS workers, because CWS worker is right, she gave my lawyer another week to look at the laws, look at what can be done, because CWS worker said that it doesn't matter how good I am now, spiritually, recovery, it doesn't matter. To her, she said it's too late. My lawyer's defense is, how is it too late as a single father? If it's to benefit the kids, how is it too late and take the only parent that's left for the kids? So the judge kind of agreed with me and my lawyer and gave us another week to figure out what we can do for that not to happen. God is good, and my hands and my kids' hands is in His hands. And whatever happens this next Monday, I'll be okay with, because obviously my higher power knows when I'm ready to get my kids back. And that's okay. Believe it or not, this is the happiest time in my life right now. I'm happy as ever. Even though I don't have my kids and my life turned upside down, it was for the good. Because without that, I would never believe in a higher power. You know, I didn't have a higher power back then. And I think everything that's happened to me is because my higher power wanted to open my eyes and say, hey, look, you're losing track. You're just dragging your kids along wherever you're going in your addiction. And it was true. I didn't see that back then. It's true. And my higher power did this to me to open my eyes so I can get back into reality and in touch with Him. And I am now. And this is the happiest ever. I may not have my kids next to me. I may be fighting for them to get them back. I may be living with my mom and lost everything from what I had. But you know what? This is the happiest time of my life, because God is good. To me, nothing but miracles. When I'm running out of money for my testing, I don't stress over it. I don't get nervous. I don't get scared. I'm like, what am I going to do? Nothing. I leave it in His hands. I talk to Him. And believe it or not, one way or another, if I'm at church, Bible study, Sunday school, wherever, somebody there always says, hey, Hector, what are you doing tomorrow? Would you like to make $60? Oh, yeah, heck yeah. I need help moving this, moving that. Okay, so I go do it. 3 days pass by, I'm at church again, at church. Someone else different. Hey, Hector, are you busy tomorrow? What do you got going on? You know what? This person's in charge of landscaping. He needs help finding gophers and getting them out of the grass. He said, I'll pay you $60. Again, 60. I'm like, he said, if you come for a couple hours and help me dig these holes out and then cover them back up. Okay, I did it. That's already another $60. Okay, I passed by this lady. I seen this lady the other day moving, and she was a plus-size woman. You could tell she was older, and she was tired. I could see it in her. She was tired. I was on my way to the EDD to do application online for Walmart. Well, something told me, turn back around and offer some help. I did. I turned back around, and I go, excuse me, do you need help with me? And she's like, oh, my God, God bless you. If you have an hour of spare, I'm so tired. If you come for like an hour, I'll pay you $60. Again, I don't know what's up with the 60, but they're giving me 60. So I'm like, sure, I have an hour. You know, the application can wait. So sure enough, I made another $60. So, nothing but miracles God is putting in front of me. And that's because I have my recovery as well. I've been 110 days clean today. 110. That's a record. I've never been this clean. And I feel great. I did gain a lot of weight. Tim, you're losing weight? I'm finding it. But it feels great. I've never felt like this before. I'm the happiest ever. I had a counseling appointment on Thursday. And I went, and before I got called in, this guy that I barely met, he's a brand new acquaintance from another program I'm doing. He shows up to drop off his wife, and he goes, "Hey, I've been looking for you. Can I get your number?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's "I heard you talking the other day in one of the groups we were at together. And you know what? I was talking to my brother about you. Me and him, they hire people for a company. And they're like, and I talked to my brother, and we'd like to hire you. Would you like to work for us starting next week?" And I'm like, "Yeah, hey, here's my number." I didn't even ask what it was. I was just excited it's a job. So sure enough, I gave him my number, and he's supposed to be calling me Monday, and I'm supposed to be starting next week a job. I have no idea what it is, but God is good, and I'll take anything that comes to me. Yes. So, I mean, that right there just shows to me that I'm doing the right thing. I believe in my higher power. I stay busy with church. By the way, Celebrate Recovery on Tuesdays. If you've never been there, I recommend it. It's off the hook. You guys should check it out. Tim knows all about it. But recovery combined with my higher power is like unstoppable. I've been so... I've never believed in what's happening to me right now. To me, it was a fluke. Like, I hear people talk about it back then, and it's like, no way, it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Especially to people like me, the way I was raised and the way I grew up, there's no way. But I noticed that it does happen. It's true, and by having faith, and by believing in a higher power, and really working your steps with a sponsor, really believing in steps, wanting to be at the AA meetings, at any meetings, sharing, and just being positive, and always reading recovery. I read recovery books. I read the Bible. I mean, anything that has any positive spiritually, whatever I read, and I stay busy. And believe it or not, I haven't had not one dream of using or drinking. I have not had any relapses. I have not had any cravings. Now, I believe that's my higher power that totally took that out, because I drank and I used for 25 years nonstop. So I hear people saying that, you know, it comes back to them in the dreams. Well, I've been lucky that my higher power hasn't had those in my dreams. And I know that my higher power has something good for me. Even though what I've been through, he's been saving me for something special. And I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait. Hopefully, I really believe something positive is going to happen this Monday with me and my kids. And it's just off the hook. I mean, everybody in AA, it's like my new family. I love being here. My church, I love being in my church. I'm there like 6 times a week. I volunteer for as much as I can. Like just today, look, out of the blue. God put me here for a reason. Tim called me up, "Hey, you have a speaker meeting today." Oh, that's right, reminded me. I showed up to help him out, and look, I'm up here. It feels great. Good to meet you, by the way. I can't wait to hear your story. But, recovery, higher power, it does work. I've lived a life of gang banging, you know, stealing, lying, cheating. I was homeless, and I still wouldn't give up my addiction. I lost my kids, and instead of being the number one dad and working at it to get them back, my addiction wouldn't let me. I fell more into it. Depression. I felt boo-hoo me. You know, I felt bad about me. Poor me, poor me. But see, I've heard a lot of people say that if that were to happen to them, there's nothing in the world they wouldn't do to get the kids back. And you know what? That was my mentality. But when it happened to me, I couldn't get out of the addiction. I felt more depressed. I felt bad. I felt bad for my kids. I cried a lot. I mean, it was just, I dug myself such a deep hole that I lost everything, all my loved ones, the trust, everything. I just lost it. Homeless. I couldn't get out of that hole. And even though my kids were up at stake, I couldn't get out. And believe me, I want to be number one dad too. I haven't seen my children or been with them, or I don't even know what school they go to, who their teachers are, their friends, nothing. You know, and that's sad. And now that I'm sober, that's a motivation for me. Now that I have a higher power, that's a motivation for me. I can't wait to one day actually be with my kids. I want to participate at their school functions. I want to sell popcorn on Fridays for them. I want to be a coach for them if I need it. You know, I have just so much things, list of things I want to do with them that I just can't wait. I'm full of energy. I want to be that parent that, wow, this is a good parent. You know, that's because I lost it all. I lost that. And I know a lot of parents now, some don't do it. Some probably do part of it. But you know what? When you lose your kids and you haven't had it for a long time, those are things that you take for granted. I wish I had them. I wish I could, you know, I know I could be a good father. And one day, like I said, it's in my higher power's hands. One day, I'll have it. I really believe that. I have faith. And I don't think nothing can stop me. God is sending me on the right path. And I love it. I love being here. I love all you guys. I go to every meeting possible here. He's actually one of the persons that introduced me to my church, it's now my home church. I never knew that church existed. And I got hooked on that church. Those people love me. That's like my other family. And believe it or not, I'd rather be here or over there than my own home. Because my own home, it's just me and my mom. And my mom is the type of person that does arts and crafts. So she likes doing her own little thing. So basically just me there with reading a book. Like today I was washing clothes all day. But I love being in these meetings. I love being at church. And I'm actually being taught how to play the drums for my church. And I'm excited. They're helping me out at that church. I already have my drumsticks. I have my drum pads, music notes. They're teaching me how to do it because I volunteered. I told them I want to play, learn how to play. I want to be a drummer for the church. The drummer there is actually volunteering his services for me because he wants to play the guitar. That's his instrument of choice. So for him to go back to his guitar, he needs someone else to take over for drums. I happen to land in the right place at the right time. Now I'm learning drums. And I can't wait to actually learn how to play these drums. I'm excited for it. I'm the type of person that volunteers to sing at the church, up in front of everybody. But you have to be so long, clean, and part of the church to do that. Which is okay. I'll get there. But I do sing out there with the audience. Like, I have a deep voice, so I sing. I love singing. It brings me, I feel alive when I sing. So these are things I never did before. And it feels great. So recovery, higher power, does work. It took me a combination of both to do it, but I am doing it. And I'm going to keep coming back because I know it does work. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm going to be going to my church, praying, talking to my higher power, believing, having faith, because it's been working for me so far. And I really believe that my higher power has something special for me, and I'm looking forward to it. And that's all I got. Okay, guys. Hope everyone had a good break, cigarette break, cake break, coffee break, a break. Okay, guys, Hector, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker for the night, or for to the evening, Mike K. from Visalia. Can you please step up here? And the podium is all yours.
Thank you, Hector. I'm Mike, alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
I learned a new prayer that helps me a while back, and I'll share it with you. And the way it goes is, Lord, fill my mouth with useful stuff and close it when I've said enough. So I'm Mike, alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 2nd, 1986. I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic. Love Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's good enough. I'll see you. You know, when I got here, I was not an alcoholic. You guys made me an alcoholic. Well, I was all those old fools that was here when I got here. When I got here, I was scamming. After my last drunk, which was New Year's Eve, 1985, I was asked by my wife at the time, or she told me, she said, I would give my right arm if you'd quit getting drunk like that. Now, she didn't say if you'd quit drinking, right? Perfect alcoholic out, right? If you'd quit getting drunk like that. The deal is I'm a blackout drinker. I had been a blackout drinker for years. I didn't start out as a blackout drinker, but I was a blackout drinker a lot in the end. And my whole deal when I got here was I was going to learn. I didn't want to learn how to drink like a gentleman, like it says in chapter 3. I didn't want people to take their hats off to me. I didn't want to learn how to drink like a gentleman. What I wanted to do was still be able to drink like a pig, like I did, but I wanted to learn how to act a little better while I was drinking. See, that was my whole deal. Okay? And that's the way it was. I started out drinking, I got plenty of time, I can tell this story. My mother used to tell it and laugh until I got sober. My parents used to have patio parties. You know, they'd have friends over and they had a nice patio and all this stuff. And they'd have little patio parties. And one of their parties, little Mikey, who was 3 years old, was going around to all the people and they give him sips of their drinks, right? You know, and get a sip from one and get a sip from somebody else. And after a little while, I was knee-walking drunk. You know, I was just plain knee-walking drunk. And my mom used to just laugh and tell that story and laugh and tell that story. And to show you I was a blackout drinker, I don't remember that. So I had to start out as a blackout drinker. That was sarcasm, you guys. But the funny part about it is when after I got sober, my mom would go, oh, that was such a horrible thing we did to you, letting you get drunk like that. Oh, that was a horrible thing. And I never said it out loud, but I said to myself, you hypocrite. You know, come on, you didn't care if little Mikey was drinking or not. I did like the effect. For a short while, my dad, both my mom and my dad drank, not to excess, really. They weren't, you know, drunks or mean or, you know, hitting me or us, you know, my sisters or anything. But they did drink. They had plenty of alcohol. And, oh, gosh, must have been about 62 or 63 because I was about 10 years old. Hams came out with this little 2-gallon little keg that fit in the refrigerator, right? And you could just tap right off it. And my dad, ooh, he liked that idea, and he got those for a while. But it was only for a short while because after a while he said, I'm drinking this stuff too much. They're going empty too fast. And, well, Dad, I never told Dad, even after I got sober, I don't think I ever told Dad that it wasn't just you drinking that, Dad. You know, when parents weren't around, it was so easy to open the refrigerator and do that tap and drink some of that beer. And, oh, I felt good. You know, I did like the effect, like it says in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Now, the other thing is I wanted to be like my dad, you know, and I admired him, and, you know, he could drink whiskey, and he was fine. And so when I was about 14, I did something. They called it the aversion program. When I was new here, they some of the old guys that were sober talked about that. They even had a program up in Kingsburg called the aversion program. And what the aversion program is they'd stick you in a room by yourself and just start feeding you alcohol and feeding you alcohol. The theory was, and you get sick and they keep feeding you alcohol. And the theory was that if you drank, you know, if you got enough alcohol for, I don't know, a couple of weeks or whatever, then you wouldn't want to drink anymore. You know, and to a man, every one of those old timers told me it didn't work. You know, it didn't work. But what I did when I was about 14, I would take a little bit of my dad's whiskey and put it in this jar that I had, and I'd hide it outside, you know, and then a little while later I'd take a little bit, just a little bit at a time, and over a couple months, right? Over a couple months, and then that jar got full, and one Saturday night, my parents were out, and this neighborhood kid and I finished off that little jar of whiskey. And as I found out later, that little jar of whiskey was a quart mason jar. And needless to say, I got sicker than a dog. And the aversion therapy worked on me through high school. You know, I didn't like drinking that much. I used other things, you know, to fit in. And I came from a country school. It was out in the country in Visalia. It's not out in the country anymore, but it was then. And then I went to the big city school in Mount Whitney, and I had to fit in. You know, it was all about me. I got to fit in. I got to have friends. I got to make these friends. Half of the people that I went to school with went to Redwood. The other half were on the other side of 198, went to Whitney. And people that I knew were in different classes than me and all this stuff, and I had to fit in, so I found the chemicals that would help me fit in with the kids, and I drank some, but not that much. As a matter of fact, I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know about any of you, but a lot of us used to drive around out in the country, you know, out between Visalia and Tulare, you know, drinking beer, and then when you get done with it, you throw the can out the window and you hear it go clank. You know, sound of a beer can going clank on the ground. Well, I remember one night we were doing this, and I really just didn't feel like doing this. And I pretended like I was done, and I threw mine out, and it went thump because it was still halfway full. And I thought, God, I hope those guys didn't hear that, because they'll know I didn't drink the whole thing. I mean, because that's the way a lot of it was when I was in Hawaii. But like I said, I did other things, and I got very popular doing those other things, and I had to. I was a sneaky son of a bitch, so I never got caught by the police. But my younger sister knew that I was getting a little bit warm with the police, and she ratted me off to my dad, which was the best thing, because he found some of my stuff and said, you'd get thrown in jail for this. So basically I kind of kept low profile and stopped doing that. And you know, I did graduate from high school, and for my graduation from high school present from my parents, they gave me a present. And that present was a one-way ticket to Hawaii. It wasn't a round trip. It was a one-way ticket to Hawaii. Right? And he was like, see ya. See ya. The whole deal with that was I had a so-called friend over in Hawaii that was living with his brother and sister-in-law. And we were riding. Now, I graduated from high school in 1970. So, you know, there's no cell phones and stuff in those days. And, gosh, calling Hawaii probably cost a fortune. I don't think I ever did. But anyway, we'd write back and forth, and he said, I got a job, I got a place for you to stay, you know, blah, 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 blah. Great. So, you know, like I said, my parents bought me a one-way ticket to Hawaii. And my mom said later, I talked to her about it years later, and she said, well, we knew that you would probably just cash in the other half and use it and then wouldn't have any money to get home if you needed to. And I go, yeah, right, Mom. You just wanted to get rid of me. And so he did. And it worked. The thing is I got off the plane and this friend of mine said, "Oh, I was going to call you the other day." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I lost my job and your job along with it. And my brother and sister-in-law split up. He moved back to the base, so we don't have a place to live. And we don't have a car because we were using my brother's car. We were going to, but he's on base now. And I had $100 in my pocket. I was 18 years old." And he said, "But there's this abandoned house we can live in." And I said, "Hey, I'm here. You know, let's do it." And we did. We lived in that abandoned house. There was a whole stretch of homes. This golf course had bought all these homes and was going to tear them down and make the golf course bigger. And there was a whole bunch of people lived in those abandoned houses. And when you're 18 years old and in Hawaii, it was fun. You know, it wasn't about, you know, drinking or doing a lot of stuff like that. It was just fun. We'd go down to the beach every day and play on the beach and stuff like that. But this guy didn't have any money. My money started running out. So we had to get a job. And the state fair was advertising for people. And we went down, myself and my friend and one of the other, a guy that lived in one of the other houses down the road went with us. And we all got hired. And my friend Richard and I were supposed to go in on Thursday, and this other guy was supposed to go in on Wednesday. And so on Thursday, we show up and told the lady we're here. And she goes, "Oh, didn't he tell you?" And we went, "What?" And she said, "Well, this guy was a jerk. I mean, all he was doing was sitting there talking to girls. So we fired him and told him to tell his friends not to show up." But I had learned as a youngster that from my dad, one of the things my dad had taught me was, if you're on the job and you got nothing else to do, sweet, pick up, do whatever. And I got there, and before we even talked to this lady, I said, "Well, I'm working. Apparently I'm on the job." So I was picking up trash and doing all this stuff. And the lady saw that, and she said, "Well, okay, we'll give you a shot." And so anyway, we got the job. They said, "Don't steal. We'll know if you steal," because we work with cash. And I didn't. I said, "Okay, I believe him." And my friend didn't believe him, and he did steal from them some. And we stayed on the beach a lot that week and stuff. And so anyway, at the end of the state fair, these people said it was a young couple, by the way, and the lady's father had just died in February, and this was in June, and her and her husband had taken over the business, you know. And it was games in the carnival, you know, throw the dart at the balloons and stuff like that. And I had fun doing that. I didn't steal and did a good job and stuff. And they said, "We can only we'd like to keep you on. Your friend, he can get out of here. He stole from us. We don't want him, but we'd like to keep you on. But we can't afford to pay you any more than minimum wage." And in minimum wage in 1970 in Hawaii was $1.69 an hour. And you can't live on that. And they knew that. And they said, "But you can come live with us." And they weren't that much older. They were only, you know, 4 or 5 years older than me. And I said, "Sure." And so I did. And what that has to do with is the first thing you do every year after the state fair is you go to the Big Island for a working vacation. Okay, you go to the island of Hawaii for a working vacation. And we did that. And we went over there, and the first night we were there, the guy, his name was Skip, said, "Okay, Mike, we're going to go out to this bar with the ride boys." And the ride boys were mostly Samoan guys, you know, and they were big. The smallest guy was 6'2", weighed 250 pounds, and he was a year younger than me. He was only 17 years old, and he was the smallest guy, you know. And so, you know, first night, you know, we went out. I bought these guys a couple rounds of Primo, you know, which is a Hawaiian beer. And, boy, they just loved me. They really did. They loved me. Oh, Mike, you good Howley boy. Howley means white, you know. Mike, you good Howley boy. You know, and I kept doing that, and I learned to fit in this way. Because I never did that in high school. You know, we never went to bars or anything in high school. I learned to fit in. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to fit in. It was, for me, it had always been all about me. You know, I wanted people to like me. I wanted people to do what I thought they should be doing. But whatever it took, I had to do for me. And so I stayed there for 3 years. You know, I lived there for 3 years and had a great time. And I learned how to drink. I actually drank socially. You know, there was only one time in that 3 years where a group of us used to go out and celebrate the moon whenever there was a full moon. We'd find a beach out somewhere and, you know, take some alcohol and some other things and stuff. And one night, one guy took a gallon of Red Mountain wine, and I had a little bit too much, and I was told later that when we got home, I was on my knees in front of the front door saying, "Open up," or something, I don't know, whatever. You know, and they were laughing and stuff. You know, it was funny. Ha! You know, that was the only blackout I ever had then. And then we moved back. My girlfriend and I moved back from Hawaii and stuff and ended up back in Visalia. And I got a job, and I wasn't drinking alcoholically that much. But whenever I drank a lot. That was my thinking. You know, I didn't black out, I guess, is what I was thinking. You know, I didn't get overly drunk and go crazy and stuff like that. But I got this job where I ended up working for 26 years at Jostens printing yearbooks. And I was working graveyard. And I remember sitting on the side of the bed one day, and I had insomnia, or so I thought. I had insomnia, and I had to drink myself to sleep. And I had this quart of vodka, and I'm sitting on the side of the bed. My girlfriend was at work or at school or something. And I was drinking it to put myself to sleep. And I thought, I don't know if I should be doing this. I don't know if this was right. And then I went, nah, you know, and kept drinking. That was the only time, so the next 10 years, that I ever thought that maybe there was a little bit of a problem. You know, maybe a little bit. And so, you know, my drinking did progress then. My drinking progressed. I ended up working at that same place. The last 8 or 10 years that I drank, I worked the perfect drinking shift. It was 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. And we get off work. I work with about 10 other guys in the press room. And one night we'd go over somebody's house and drink and shoot craps. And one night we'd go over somebody else's house and drink and play pool. And one night we'd go over somebody's house and drink and shoot cards or play cards. And you notice I said the drinking first, right? And then playing the cards and stuff. And that's the way we did it. And it was fine. You know, I don't remember going home a lot of nights. And towards the end of my drinking, I remember I had this great big four-wheel drive van. I remember sometimes getting up. Now, I never got up in the morning. I'd usually get up. I had to be at work at 3. I'd usually get up about 1 in the afternoon. It was great because my wife and her kids were gone and all this stuff. You know, I didn't have to mess with anything. I'd get up, throw up, get myself together. And there was a lot of times before would go to work, I'd walk around that van and check it just to make sure there wasn't any blood on it or any dents in it, because I'd go home from guys' houses not knowing, you know, that I went home. you know, blackout drinking, pure blackout drinking. And I still didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just thought, I hope I didn't hurt anybody. The last 2 years of my drinking, I didn't even drink with those guys after work. And the reason for that is I would have to share. And there was no way was I going to be able to share with those guys. You know, I love drinking whiskey. And I hear people a lot talk about Jack Daniels. Oh, they drink Jack Daniels, Jack Daniels. And I share, when people share that, I share, Jack Daniels for me was usually at Christmas time or if I got some kind of bonus. Usually my whiskey was, I love drinking whiskey, and my whiskey was Cream of Kentucky, you know, because that's what was most affordable at Albertsons. And I'd go home from Albertsons every night. They knew me by my first name at Albertsons because I'd stop there every night, you know. And, so the last few years, I drank alone. I'd go home, the wife and her kids would be asleep. I'd turn on the TV and I'd just sit there and drink. And I didn't think I was alcoholic. It was just what I was doing. But what I was doing was I was drinking at you, at everybody in the world. What had happened with me was my selfishness, self-centeredness. To me, nobody in the whole world was doing things the way I thought they should do. Now, I had no idea what those things were they should do, but still, I thought people weren't doing things the way they should be doing. And so I would go home and I would drink those thoughts out. I'd drink them out. You know, every night. I hated weekends because then my wife and her kids, I had to be around them, and I couldn't drink like that. You know, that's the way I was the last couple of years. And the other part too, there was a lot of anger. For what reasons, I have no idea. Part of it was people just weren't doing things my way, and there was a lot of hate inside me. And I share this only because I want to share how low I got in my mind. I had an assault rifle, and some people call them machine guns, but it was an assault rifle with a 30 round clip, and I had that thing sitting right next to me on the chair every night. And, you know, we had a front door with a screen door. And this was like in, you know, July, August, September. I'd open that door just a little bit, about that much, you know, because I lived about 3 blocks from all those lowlifes that drank and used drugs and all that stuff. See, I mean, I did too, but they were lowlifes, you know. They were the ones that would want to steal and stuff like that. And I honestly was hoping that somebody would see that door partway open and try and think they were breaking into my house and I could shoot them and kill them legally. That was the way I thought. You know, that's the way I thought when I got here. And I am definitely not that person today. You know, I'm not that person today. And like I said, my wife had said I'd give my right arm if you quit drinking like that. And she wrote down on the second day of January the central office's phone number. You know, she put down AA and wrote central office phone number. I had a plan. I got a plan. I'm a good alcoholic. I had a plan. I was going to get somebody to take me to that A&A place, and I was going to listen to all those old winos and winettes and stuff, and I was going to figure out how I was acting wrong and then learn how to act right while I still drank. Okay? That was the way it was. So I called Dottie. Dottie was in charge of the central office, and it's funny, Dottie always loved me because I was the first successful. The central office had only been open 2 months then. And they had opened it in November of 85. And I was her first successful 12-step. And she sent a man out named Sailor Ken. And this guy, he wouldn't even come to my house. He met me at the store down by my house. And the reason for that is, you know, when you do 12-step work, you usually take two people. And there wasn't two people. There was just him. And Dottie had probably warned me. This guy didn't sound too good. And so Sailor Ken met me down there. And this was January. And my vision of people that were in AA were a bunch of old guys that were all humped over. Well, that looked like me, like I look today, you know, all gray hair and all that stuff like that. And Sailor Ken had his head shaved. And he had a trench coat on, and he did come walking out of that store, you know, kind of hunched over and stuff. And he had said on the phone, I'll meet you. I'll be in my black sports car. And that black sports car was a Plymouth Champ, you know. And I thought, oh, gosh, what a, you know. Okay. So anyway, Ken took me to a meeting. And he said, how you feeling? And I said, not too good. I'm not doing too good. You know, this is only, I didn't really, I, you know, was coming down off of the New Year's thing and the 1st of January thing and stuff. And he said, yeah, that's what happens when you're withdrawing. And I thought, this guy's nuts. I'm not a heroin addict. I'm not withdrawing, because in my mind, it was drug addicts that withdraw, not alcoholics. Well, yes, we do withdraw. It's just a matter of semantics with grammar, right? But in my, with the two brain cells I had left, you know, that were bouncing back and forth together, I said, and this guy was nuts. Okay? So he took me to a meeting, a noon meeting, because I was working swing shift. He took me to a noon meeting at Pine Recovery. All I remember about that meeting is Ken kept giving me cigarettes, because I didn't take any, because I didn't know if it was okay to smoke. I didn't know anything about AA at all. And there was this guy in there. I only remember, I mean, there was other people shared, but there was this guy with a very bolsterous voice that was saying, God has done this for me, and God can do this for me, and God could and would if he were sought, and God this and God that. And that's all I remember. And I remember walking down that hallway out of Pine saying my very first prayer that I ever said. I said it to myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was, God, what have I got myself into? You know, because in my, I was not raised in a good Christian home. I mean, we just didn't go to church, you know. Anytime God was mentioned in our house, it was usually two words were said after that, and it was, damn it, Mike. You know. My parents weren't agnostics or anything. They just didn't go to church and didn't have us go to church. You know, so there was, my perception of God was, anything bad that ever happened to me, it wasn't me. I didn't do that. It wasn't me. God was doing that to me because God hated me. You know, that's what I thought when I got here. And I said, God, what have I got myself into? And I didn't realize how much of a loving God that I have today and that I had that day. Because that day, Sailor Ken put his arm on my shoulder, you know, as we were walking out, and said, I want to take you and introduce you to some people. And he took me down to the alarm, because I was planning on, I was going to tell him, I'm going to go over to the library, Ken, and I got some stuff to do, and then I was going to get a ride home, because I didn't want any of this AA stuff, if they had God stuff to do with it. No, forget it. You know, but Sailor Ken said, come with me, and I did. And he took me down to the Alana Club, and there was about five people down there. They all smiled at me. And they shook my hand and said, welcome, it's good to see you. It's nice to meet you. You know, keep coming back. And that was so foreign to me. I mean, I wasn't welcome in my own mind. I wasn't welcome in my own home when I got here. You know, and these people, they were just so friendly. You know, and they were so nice. And there was this lady, she was about this tall. She was about 150 years old. It was old Alice. Cheryl, remember Alice? You know, and God bless Alice McClary. You know, I didn't realize at the time, Alice had gotten sober in 1953. I was a year old when Alice got sober. But anyway, I was talking with Alice, and I don't remember what I said to her. And I asked her later, and she didn't remember either. But I said something to her, and she said these words to me that I didn't realize it then, but it got me. It got me to stay here. It was God, my God today, talking through Alice. And Alice said, "That's okay, honey. We understand." That's what she said. And then she got out this little card that had the, it was laminated, it had the steps and the traditions and stuff like that on it. It is still my bookmark in my first big book, you know. But I didn't realize it, and it kind of took me aback. And she said, "That's okay, honey. We understand." And we do understand. That's just it, you know. We do understand. It took me a while to learn it. I thought I was fine when I got here. You know, I thought I was great. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not, you know, I was fine. But this is how well put together my brain was when I got here. Mostly I went to noon meetings because I worked swing shift. And they would ask at the beginning of the meeting if, you know, people getting chips, right? And anybody that got a chip would always get called on. Okay? And, you know, during the meeting, Joe got a chip. Joe, share with us. Or, you know, Steve got a chip. Steve, share with us. Share with us. So I absolutely believed up here in this brain that I thought was doing so well that if I got a chip and what was going on up here came out of my mouth here, I would be asked to leave and not come back. That's how sick I was in my brain, you know. And it took me 90 days to figure that out, you know. I finally figured it out when, I don't know, some of you know Average Dave. Average Dave came in a few days after me, and he talked, and nobody ever asked him to leave, you know. But I finally did that. And, you know, I used to share that all the time, and when I was, I don't know, about 4 years sober or something, one of my sponsees, he had about 6 months, and he came over to my house. We were talking and stuff, and he gave me his 30 and 60 day chip. And he said, "You know, you really do deserve this, you know." And that's that thing. We understand, you know, we understand each other. We understand the different things. And, so anyway, It wasn't long before that whole idea of that 90 days and learn how to do this and then I'm out of here and stuff was gone, because it says in the book here, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Okay? And I wanted what people had, because people were laughing with each other, patting each other on the back, shaking each other's hands, and just having a great time. I wanted that. I wanted that. Okay? And those people that were laughing and sharing and had that I wanted shared things in the meetings. Like, I go to a lot of meetings. I got a sponsor who has obviously worked the steps and is working the steps with me. And my sponsor has also gotten me to do service work, even little service work like cleaning out ashtrays, you know. And that stuck with me, you know, that stuck with me, especially the part about getting a sponsor. Now, I said, okay, I want to do this thing. I want to get a sponsor, but I'm a sneaky bastard. I know I'm going to mess with this guy. And I'm going to lie to him and everything else just to make myself sound good. So I really wanted what everybody had. So I said, I need to get somebody that will kick my butt if I do that. So I asked this guy who said that he was a former Hell's Angel. He had moved down here from Fresno, and there's Hell's Angels in Fresno. His name was Woody. And he talked like he was a badass in the meetings. You know, he talked like a badass. He said, "I don't use nothing. I don't even let a dentist put Novocaine in me when I'm getting my teeth worked on." Okay. You know, so I figured this guy, I needed this guy. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said yes. And you know, it's funny because he was a badass in meetings, but when we would get together, just him and me, he knew exactly what to do. He treated me with a lot of tenderness, with a lot of love, with a lot of kindness, and did walk me through the steps. And I will always, everly be grateful to Woody, you know, for doing that. But I kind of outgrew Woody, and I got a different sponsor. And you know, when I was coming up on a year, it was sometime in mid-November or something. You know, I was still working swing shift, working 3 to 11. I'd come home at night, and I was into tapes because I couldn't call anybody at midnight. You know, hey, I need to, I was afraid to, you know, and I didn't want to bother anybody or anything, but people had turned me on to tapes, and I heard some of the best tapes in the world, the funniest tapes, the Arkansas Traveler, and I heard some of the stories that were just so sad, and these people had all gotten sober, you know, and I got into tapes and stuff. But I also got into doing some woodworking. And in my inventory, I found out I was making wooden toys. And I found out in my inventory that I made wooden toys and went to craft shows with another guy that was in sobriety who painted. We'd go to craft shows and they'd just have a great time. We'd have a fun time. And I found out in my inventory that I liked making toys because when I was a little kid and I'd get mad at somebody, I'd break my own toys. Ah, genius. I'd break my own toys. But that's one of the things that the inventory helped me with. But I was, you know, working, doing this woodwork, and then I go to work and this and that, go to meetings, go to noon meetings, and I do woodwork and this and that. And this lady shared one thing, you know, and I thought I was doing, you know, a lot better. And I was coming up on a year, and this lady shared in a meeting, she said, "I hide from myself in my work." And my stomach just churned. I went, something's up. And so I had gotten another sponsor. I grabbed my new sponsor and said, "We're working through the steps again." Because I was hiding from myself. You know, I hadn't worked my steps as thoroughly as I really needed to. But I had gotten into service work. Larry Sloan, who's not around anymore, he got me to, they take H&I meetings in the Pine a couple times a month. And after, when I was about 11 months sober, or maybe right at a year, he got me to take over that meeting. You know, and it was really great because I could ask people, I could talk to people, "Would you like to come, please, and share at Pine?" You know, I got to meet people and all that stuff. And that was, you know, doing service work. That was getting out of self. That was the main thing I had to do, was get out of self. And for the last 31 years, it has been, no matter what, I need to do whatever to get out of self. You know, I'd love to be able to say, "I got sober, the world's fine, everything's fine, you know, there's been no problem." You know, sober, S-O-B-E-R, son of a bitch, everything's real. S-O-B-E-R, right? Everything's real. And life was still real. At my second AA birthday, you know, at the club they used to have, you know, families, and they still do at some meetings, the families come in and share and stuff like that. And at my second AA birthday, my wife, the one that I was married to when I got sober, you know, was saying, "Oh, Mike's so wonderful now, everything's great, blah, 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 blah." About a month later, she's going, "I can't live with you anymore. I don't want to be married to you." You know, and I just said, you know, and I just said, okay. Because I had learned about acceptance, you know, that Dr. Paul wrote about in the book. And that acceptance means you don't have to like it. You just have to be spiritually okay with it. And by my second year of sobriety, I had gotten a God, a loving God, you know. For the first 8 months of my sobriety, the group was my higher power, you know. But I had gotten a higher power. And the thing is I was, she didn't like what I was doing. I was going to a lot of meetings. By that time I was working graveyard, so I could go to night meetings. I was going to conventions. She wasn't one of us. She, you know, didn't want to go to conventions. I'd go to conventions with, Average Dave. The first convention, I got to share this. The first convention I ever went to was over in San Luis Obispo. And you know, conventions always have a motto, and their motto sticks with me today. And I hope it sticks with all of you. Their motto was, "I can't, we can," you know, and that's the whole thing. We can. We understand each other, and we can. You know, we understand it when somebody talks about, yes, in step two, I had trouble. And, you know, I thought that I was sane, but I learned about the insanity of my drinking. You know, I learned all of those things over the years. In sobriety, there's been a lot of adverse things happen, and there's been some of the most fantastic things happen. I met a woman after that woman divorced me. I met a woman, and we ended up getting married. We were living together for a while. We started a taping business because my friend Earl down in Bakersfield shared. I used to loan tapes to people. You know, I was working. I didn't mind. I'd loan tapes to people, and they wouldn't give them back, and then they'd avoid me, you know, because they felt guilty, you know, and they'd avoid me. And I didn't want to be. I was avoided when I was drinking. I didn't want to be avoided in sobriety. And so Earl said, "Mike, if you want to do this, just sell it to them. If they want them bad enough, just sell it to them." So I started that, and Carolyn and I did that. And people lovingly tried to tell us that it's not good for a couple in recovery to be in business together. And we go, "Oh, no, no, we're spiritual. We're fine. We're fine." And as some of you know, Carolyn and I divorced in 1994 from being in business together. But the thing is, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, Carolyn and I are the best of friends today. As a matter of fact, she shared in a meeting just the other day. I give her rides to meetings because she can't walk too good anymore. And she shared that my best friend today is Mike, you know. It's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's only because of these steps. It's only because we understand each other, you know. We really do understand each other. And, you know, I'm going to stop in just a second. One of the things I wanted to share was I really got into a lot of service. I'm the one who in 1989 went out to the Corcoran prison with a shirt and tie on and all nice and went in to talk to the warden to see about getting AA meetings started at the Corcoran prison because it was new then. And I went in, sat down with the warden, and I introduced myself and started talking, and he goes, "It's okay. Glad to see you. We've been waiting for you." Because he had worked at Tehachapi, and he had worked at Solano and other prisons where they had AA already. And he goes, "We've just been waiting for you." You know, I got meetings started. I was the area chairman for H&I for 4 years. And I got the meeting started back out at Bob Wiley and a lot of stuff like that. You know, I've done a lot of service work. I've been an alternate DCM. You know, I was doing GSR work. I did a lot with central office. And I worked my way up the ladder to as high as you get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a sober member, just like everybody else. We're all just sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's as high as you get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have learned that, and I have been able to live that through the loving God that I have been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing I want to share real quick is at 10 years sobriety, I decided I liked printing. It was okay, but I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do something more. I wanted to give somehow. So I decided I wanted to teach. I thought I wanted to be a teacher. So I went to school full time, first COS and then Fresno Pacific. And it took me 5 years, but I did it while I worked full time at Jostens. And I became a teacher out in Woodlake at a continuation school. Kids that were just like me when I was in high school, you know. And I worked there for 15 years. I just retired there. And I loved being able to do that. I loved being able to basically not let them get away with all the crap that they were getting away with before, you know, because I knew better. You know, I loved being able to help them succeed in school, you know, help them succeed in life, because there was a lot of kids that had horrible, horrible family lives and stuff. And, you know, it's been fantastic. You know, it's been a fantastic journey that I've been on for the last 31 years. I wouldn't trade a second of it, the bad stuff or the good stuff, you know, for a second. You know, I wouldn't trade it for a second. And I just want to thank you. Thanks, Zach, for asking me to speak. You're right, Zach. I had plenty of time. I mean, I had plenty of time.